Blog Talk Radio.
All right, so this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yo, and it's the Tornado, Tony Pennington.
And hopefully this week we will have no issues with the recording. Last week we had a major nightmare with nobody was able to call in correctly. We actually weren't recorded for the first hour of the show. I had to use the backup recording as a replacement for the show, so we apologize for anyone who tuned in and got dead air. But we replaced it with half of the show anyway. We got half of the show in. So this week, hopefully Blog Talk Radio has their shit together and we can proceed accordingly. But we got a lot to talk about. We had a big UFC 163 and a big main event there. A lot of injuries to talk about there. But I watched the Friday night fights, but didn't really turn a lot of heads. That show actually, they had that Friday night fights edition had Teddy Atlas apologizing because he promised a good fight in the main event. In both main fights they showed weren't very good.
Yeah, I might even fall asleep. I think I did. No, like I said, and that's not, you know, a reflection on the show or the fight. I hate when they put shit on later than they should, especially now that I'm trying to get my schedule back in order. And here's the thing that's screwed up about me. And if you haven't known by now how screwed up I am, I'm a guy that, you know, if I don't have to work the next day, and I'm like, all right, you know, I went to work today, you know, I'm done. I'm going to go watch TV. And then next thing you know, what happens? I fall asleep. If I know I got to work the next day, then I'm like, oh, right, you know, I'm up. I'm like, I'm usually because I'm weeknights I work out. And no, I was incorrect. I did not fall asleep actually because I was at the casino.
Huh. Well, there you go. Well, it really wasn't worth talking about. There was a lot of back and forth, but you know, these guys really didn't try to beat the hell out of each other at all. And wasn't exciting, and if you missed it, you didn't miss much. But UFC 163 was a little bit better. Talk about guys wanting to try to kill each other. We had a lot of injuries, a lot of big time suspensions, and instead of talking about the finances this week, we're gonna, I guess, talk about suspensions. Let's connect Tom here. Tom, how's it going? Second Tom.
All right. How are we doing, guys?
Hey. Hi. Good. Well, we have a big UFC 163 from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and main event there was Jose Aldo versus Chan Sung Jung, otherwise known as the Korean Zombie. And this is a fight where both guys got injured. Jose Aldo actually was like 2 minutes into the fight, I think. He had a busted foot from kicking the knee of the Zombie. And the poet didn't know it. Broke his foot. It was kind of something that the announcers or the commentators, I guess you call them, didn't miss a beat on, because they kept talking about how he wasn't doing any low kicks, leg kicks. So they nailed that one, and Aldo didn't really kick at all. He was pretty much all punching and wrestling through most of the fight, and then the Korean Zombie threw a big old looping right hand that missed, and his shoulder came out of socket. And then that was the first time Aldo really threw some meaningful kicks. He kicked the arm and knocked it down to the ground and then finished it up on the ground. Actually, I also read yesterday that Aldo had kidney stones, too, after the fight. So
he's in the sand.
He's suspended for 90 days with no contact for 60 days due to his fractured right foot. Chan Sung-yong is suspended for 180 days or until he has an MRI on his shoulder and gets cleared by a doctor. But that was pretty brutal. I had no idea what was happening as it happened, of course, but it looked like all of a sudden as he was backing up against the cage, he like shivered like he was cold all of a sudden. But he was actually trying to put his shoulder back in the socket, according to his interview after.
I've done that.
There was even a few
comments about how Aldo took advantage of him, but I don't know. The last time I checked, you keep fighting till the referee says stop.
Right.
Very simple equation. I mean, some of these commentators. And I'm not talking about, well, maybe even the professional ones, but some of these posters know nothing about this, nothing. They know nothing to say something that idiotic. I mean, sure, you know, you could see he was hurt, but you didn't know Aldo can't read his mind. Everyone's not psychic, you know. Come on.
Right. And, you know, there's no rule that says you can't hit somebody if they're hurt. You know, you don't have to stop and point to his arm and go, ref, come on, do something. You've got to keep fighting.
That's up to the referee. Yeah, that's up to the ref.
And, you know, Aldo didn't really go ballistic on the ground either. It ended pretty quickly after Young hit the ground and they waved it off pretty quickly after that, so no big deal there. It wasn't really a test for Aldo anyway. I mean, I think he was just kind of cruising through the fight. He gave Young a black eye in addition to the bad shoulder, but he really was fighting a strategic fight, and he actually kind of got criticized at the post-fight press conference for using more strategy than ever before and not being, overbearing in this fight and trying to prove a point.
Assuming he had an off night, to me that just shows how great he is. I mean, he had the injury, he showed another side of himself, and he defended his title. I mean, again, people are so quick to criticize.
Exactly. And speaking of criticism, I was one of the ones that gave some heavy criticism of the co-main event, Lyoto Machida versus Phil Davis. Davis got a couple takedowns that were notable, but other than that, he really didn't seem like he was pushing the action much at all, or you know, even landing many of his strikes. He did throw a lot of strikes, but just didn't seem to be landing much at all. And he got the win. He got 29-28 on all three cards, so you can't point to one or two judges as not seeing the same fight. All of them apparently saw the same fight, but it's also kind of a judgment on Machida's style because, you know, this is a karate expert. His style hasn't changed in his last few fights at all. He doesn't seem to be getting any better or worse for that matter, I guess. But he just doesn't seem to be, evolving. So I think he kind of got punished for that because the judges
Exactly. Exactly, and maybe this is a little bit of karma from that first Shogun Hua fight. There were a few comments along those lines, but the bottom line, he's just got to, he could have been more aggressive, I thought, but, you know, don't leave it in the hands of the judges.
Right. I think it was just a matter of the takedowns being judged as the difference in the first two rounds. And I find that to be kind of a pain in the ass with some of these decisions because at a local show, if, you know, a fight is close or something like that, it's no big deal. I mean, there's not that much money on the line. But in this situation, Machida with a win would probably be in line for a title spot, a bigger payday, and a lot of different things. So there's a lot riding on it. And, you know, one takedown, a takedown is one thing, but the way these takedowns happen, it really didn't prove any dominance on Phil Davis's part. He didn't really do much with him. It's one thing if you take a guy down at the beginning of the round and you keep him going. But if it happens at the end of the round and you maybe land a couple body punches here and there because of it, it doesn't overshadow the fact that Machida came right at him in the first round and landed a bunch of shots and had him up against the cage and almost knocked him out at one point.
Well, how many years? How many years have we been talking about the unified rules? How many years? What do you think? 10? You know, 10, 15, 20? I mean, that's 1993, you know? And
but the rules have nothing to do with the judging. I mean, the judging criteria is so subjective, I don't think there are any rules on the judging.
Well, but you got to admit, though, the unified rules, I think, gives a little more awards for takedowns, which is fine if you create some damage with it.
Right.
And that's if you look at the rule book as it's written, it almost just gives rewards for the takedown. That's part of the control. But I mean, to me, I want to see something happen once we're down.
Right. Well, Machida suspended for 30 days for whatever reason. He didn't look like he had a scratch on his face or a bruise or anything, but I guess they have precautionary suspensions too. Phil Davis actually also busted his foot, so he'll be out for 180 days or until he gets his right foot x-rayed and cleared. I really think he lost that fight. He kind of took a lot of tough questions at the post-fight press conference, but I found it really kind of funny. He didn't obviously find it funny, but one reporter, you know, asked him if he felt disrespected. And he said, well, I haven't even seen the fight, you know, so I can't judge it for myself whether I won or lost. You know, when you're in it, you can't tell. So it wasn't very, he didn't seem offended at all.
Yeah.
And he didn't seem to be really lobbying for himself either at the same time that, you know, he was convinced that he won.
Yeah, that was a very strange answer. Very strange answer.
And they asked him, you know, whether he thought he earned a shot against John Jones, and he didn't even seem to jump at that opportunity either. So, I don't know. He's not very good with the cameras in the press. He even asked for a question to be repeated and said, you know, I'm a professional fighter for a living. So, you know, you gotta ask me twice sometimes.
But he also has a degree in something. You know, he's a college graduate. It's not like he's inarticulate.
Right.
I don't know.
But I mean, my article on the whole.
And I guess the question, where do both guys go from here on that?
Right. I don't know. I don't think that the UFC was too crazy about Machida fighting John Jones again, but Dana White actually supposedly tweeted something about he thought Machida won the fight. So
right.
That right there kind of tells you that, you know, at least he had the perspective that Machida won. But either way, I mean, none of the guys were that dynamic, so I don't think they're going to be in the title picture anytime soon just because of that. I think both of them would have to have another impressive fight, if not a rematch, to really prove one way or another that they earned the title shot. But, you know, it's going to happen months from now, if anything, because of the suspension. But my article on the whole subject basically kind of compared Phil Davis to Czech Congo. He's no longer with the UFC because he's such a physical specimen, but he's got no game to match his physique, basically. You know, you think a guy like that who's a really good wrestler would know to try to get those takedowns way earlier in the fight, and he didn't even attempt to in a lot of those rounds. And especially after you get one in the first round, you'd think right in the second round, right off the bat, you'd really try to get him. He didn't. And, you know, I've never really seen a fight of his where he's been a dynamic striker or a wrestler and done a lot of damage and had the crowd cheering for him. So maybe he needs to look at his game too, but both of them just did not have exciting styles. So, so they want the big bucks and the big bonuses that Dana White gives out. They're going to have to change their game plan a little.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That in like boxing terms, would be like Corey Spinks enough of a knockout of the night.
Right, right, good point.
You've got to see the knockout since like 2004.
Right. And then moving on, we had Cesar Ferreira He choked out Thiago Santos. I think it was a guillotine choke, if I remember correctly. It was a pretty quick one. Then we had Thales Leites and Tom Watson. I don't have the results right in front of me, but Leites had a pretty incredible fight there. Good return to the UFC and dominated that one. John Lineker got a knockout over Jose Maria Chome. Vinny Magohates was knocked out by Anthony Perosh, and that one was kind of a weird situation because it only took Perosh 14 seconds to get that knockout. But what was weird about it was his 14th win, and he got it in 14 seconds, and he's coming off a loss, which was his 7th loss, and that loss happened in 7 seconds. So he's probably the first fighter in history to have that happen.
Okay,
boxing
so, seven and seven is quite a coincidence, huh?
Yeah, and he got the knockout of the night, I think, for that one. So he's definitely showing that he still belongs, and he's going to hang around for a while. He's over 40 years old, so he got a couple questions about you know, whether he's in it for the long haul.
And apparently, Vinny has said that if the UFC cuts him, he's going to retire. It's just I don't know how to put my finger on him. I mean, the guy was just, his jiu-jitsu is off the charts, and yet it just doesn't seem to translate. I mean,
I'll just chalk it up to the fact that he's sponsored by Zions.
Okay.
He's actually one of those people that on Twitter he refuses to let me follow him. Even I can understand if I he won't follow me back, but he has a block on me because I run the ZionSucks.com Twitter account. So takes his sponsorship seriously, I guess. But, so I'm not crying about his loss. But anyway, he didn't really look like he had much offense in that one. But it is what it is. Anyway, Amanda Nunes was the first female to fight for the UFC in front of a Brazilian crowd. In the first Brazilian female, I should say. And she was suspended for 180 days because I guess she broke her rib somehow, even though she beat the ever-living crap out of Sheila Gaff, who was only suspended for 45 days, while Nunes gets a 180-day suspension for that one. But she did pretty good in that. I don't know if she made a case to be Ronda Rousey's next opponent or anything, but she definitely showed she can fight. And we had Sergio Moraes. He beat Neil Magny with a pretty slick triangle choke. That was a pretty interesting fight. Rolled him right over with it and then made him tap out. Then we had Ronnie Yaya won his fight. I forget who he fought off the bat. But the fight of the night was Eliardo Santos versus Ian McCall. McCall broke his hand, so he's suspended for 180 days. Santos has a 30-day suspension. but I really didn't find that fight that exciting. But I guess Dana White had to give it to somebody, so he gave it to them. That pretty much rounds up the major fight. But I think the next one is the one in Boston on the 17th, fight night 26 or something they're calling it. But we'll preview that next week. I want to get into a little bit of boxing news here. Before we have our debate, instead of the guest tonight, we're going to have a big debate, or actually kind of more of a discussion, I guess, on performance-enhancing drugs, seeing as this is the week of the Alex Rodriguez suspension and the whole Biogenesis deal.
Which I know that broke your heart.
Oh, yeah. That's tough. You know, I hate seeing the Yankees do so bad, too. It's just distraught. But I'm just glad that he's done so shitty since he's come back. And I think he's got one hit both times out so far. So just another thing to make the Yankees suck.
Yeah, and I heard he was hit by a pitch ball last night, and the crowd actually cheered him. So
that's the first. Well, the one game the other night, a Braves game, made the news because somebody got plunked just for showing attitude after hitting a home run, and it was a 20-year-old. Kid that hit the home run, and all the news stations were talking about it because they hit him after the fact. And you know, they actually showed a clip on ESPN of a bunch of other guys playing against the Braves who did the same thing, and they didn't get plunked. I guess it was just a personal thing against that one kid. But anyway, we'll get to that whole discussion later. There's no publicly named boxers or MMA fighters other than Uriarchus Gamboa who are implicated in this whole biogenesis thing, but I actually found it pretty easy to locate the number of this Porter M. Fisher, who is the one who's the whistleblower in this case. So I might try to give him a call myself and see if I can get him to give me some clues on, you know, who those fighters are, because there's not just one guy. He had mentioned in some interviews that there's some mixed martial artists and boxers, plural, involved. So I don't know why nobody's pressed him on that or nobody's been able to get that out of him. But I've got a couple phone numbers for him down there in Miami. So I'm going to try to track that down this week and put on my investigative reporter hat, see what I can discover. But before we get into that whole discussion, I wanted to mention that there was a protest that we talked about a little while back of the Derek Chisora and Malik Scott bout over there in the UK. And we have some clarification and a decision on that. They are not going to reverse the fight or the decision or, you know, force a rematch or anything. And basically, the whole idea of 10 count, they don't do that in the UK for some reason. According to this explanation that I just got a hold of today. According to the General Secretary of the British Boxing Board of Control, a guy named Robert Smith, he says it's correct to reference that Mr. Scott had nothing on the canvas but his feet at the count of nine, but under the British Boxing Board of Control rules, a boxer is deemed to be down by one of four criteria, one of which is when the boxer is in the act of rising. Therefore, the point at which the boxer has nothing on the canvas but his feet is not the point at which the boxer is no longer down. Most importantly, after a boxer is down, boxing can only continue when the boxer is in a position and condition to defend himself. And the latter point, I guess, is referring to Scott's failure to bring up his guard at the request of the referee when he finally did get to his feet.
Well, here's a point I gotta make. If anybody's seen that, Scott is pretty much, he's on his feet at the count of nine. You know, his knees are still slightly bent, but it's not like he's on a knee. It's not like he still was, I'll say, about 80% standing up, fully erect, when the referee said the count of nine. Now, I've seen a lot of fights. I've been in fights. I've been on the canvas. I've knocked guys on the canvas. I've refereed in like amateurs and exhibitions. And here's the thing. Okay, I was refereeing the college bout one time. And the one fighter got hit, and he got stunned. And he didn't go down, but I gave him a standing A count. And I'm standing here, and I'm looking him in the eye as I'm counting. Six, seven, eight. Then, are you okay? Put your hand, and then most of the time he'd have his hands up. And then it's walk towards me to prove that he could move on steady legs. Now, in professional fights, there's no difference, really, honestly. Okay, a fighter gets knocked down. You have you know, a mandatory eight count. So he might have got up at 10 or 3. Just because, you know, he doesn't get up by the count of 8, that's why it's called a 10 count. So, okay, so he got up at the count of 3. You still count to 8. The fighter generally will have his hands up. You look him in the eyes. You ask him to walk towards you. You wipe his gloves off. Now, if a fighter gets up at the count of 9, you cannot expect him to have his hands up the moment he gets to on his feet. You know, you got to look that fighter in the eye. Now, you get to the count of 9. That's not 10. Get to the count of 9. Look him in the eye. Are you okay? Can you continue? Walk towards me. The fighter walks towards you, shows that he is okay and ready to continue. You then take his gloves. You wipe them off on your shirt. You tell the fighters to resume. This referee did not do that.
According to this guy, he did request that he bring up his guard.
But the guy was still getting on his feet. I don't know any fighter, and believe me, I've gotten off the canvas myself. I've never cut off the canvas with my hands already up. I'm trying to get myself right. Actually, and anybody listening right now, what am I on the ground? You know what? In fact, I got a better idea. I used to play this game when I was a kid. Spin around for about 30 seconds. You're going to get dizzy. You're going to fall down. Then get up. And tell me if the time you, the second, the very millisecond that you have both your soles on the ground, if your hands are up. No, because generally you're trying usually, at some point, you usually push yourself up. And when you're standing up, your hands are generally coming up from your waist. I've never remember seeing a fighter stand up and the second he got up, his hands are already up. No, there's generally a second or two delay. The referee stopped the fight on the count of 9, and that's bullshit.
Well, here's the other
problem. He was on his feet before the count of 10. He was on his feet. The referee could look at him for 10 seconds if he wanted to. He could look at him, walk towards me. Are you okay? Do you want to continue? Okay, come on, walk towards me. And then if he feels fit that the fighter is not responding and is not fit to continue, then at his discretion can he stop the fight. No, the referee flubbed this call. Now, does that mean that Malik Scott was going to win that fight? No, I think I thought he was winning, but I thought he was hurt. And I thought, you know, he was starting to take some punishment. He might have been stopped the very next round, but you need to give him that opportunity.
Well, the other part of this explanation is that 10 is never actually recited in a boxing count in some countries, which the UK is one of them. And the procedure is to count 7, 8, 9, and then out. 10 is never called by any referee in any contest in this country, according to this guy explaining this whole thing.
Okay, can I count at that point, too? This is why I had coworkers that I should have been a lawyer, because I love arguing. You know when you feel like I'm right, that I'm going to battle. Okay, I'm going to get back to another point. He was on his feet at 10 of 9. So even if it was 7, 8, 9, you're out, which is pretty goddamn ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I've watched a lot of fights, 7, 8, 9, 10, you're out. I mean, it's not because if the fighter got up, you know, if he's on his ass at the 10 of 10, it doesn't matter if he got up at what would have been the count of 11. You're out is you're out.
Right.
But, okay, 7, 8, 9, you're out. He's still up at the count of 9.
I don't agree myself with this explanation and this reporting. The explanation.
I'm not arguing with you guys. I'm just arguing with the moron that wrote this. Okay, another one that I really enjoyed, kind of on the same lines. Watching a fight one time a couple of years ago, and a fighter, he starts getting, you know, potatoed pretty good, and he gets knocked down. Boom. He's on his ass. And he's trying to get up, and I give him credit. He tries to get up, and the referee counts 10 as he's trying to get himself up, and he got up right into the count of 10. It was a legitimate 10 count. And then he starts, and then the referee's waving it off. Obviously, 7, 8, 9, 10, you're out. And he's like, no, I'm okay. And even the announcement that came at 10 is 10. He's not stopping the fight. He reached the count of 10.
Right. Well, the count of 10 might be reached in this fight. Sounds like, I don't know if anything's official, but Shane Mosley is probably going to end up fighting Amir Khan on December 7th.
Wow, that's interesting.
I thought that was kind of surprising myself. I know that Mosley is not looking to fight any slouches in his comeback, but... you know, it seems like he's getting the fast track to the biggest fighters in the business. So Amir Khan is a pretty big name for him to be stepping up against.
Yeah, Amir Khan, very big name. And, you know, this is a fight that really is low risk, high reward for a guy like Mosley. Because you figure, you know, I mean, obviously there's a physical risk, but there always is when you step inside the ring. You look at it like this. Nobody expects Mosley to win. You know, the beating you took from Manny Pacquiao, or the beating you took from Mayweather a couple years ago, then he took the beating from Pacquiao, you know, the following year. Then he took an even worse beating from Canelo Alvarez. So he, and then he had a lackluster draw in there with Sergio Mora. So he had four rather uninspiring performances. Then, you know, he retired, came back after that, won a split decision then in Mexico over a fighter I really don't even remember. So... everybody's like, oh, Mosley's probably just hanging off for the money, or, you know, he's delusional. Now, I thought it was wrong they were going to give him a title shot with Malignaggi after he lost 3 out of 4 fights, you know, and he got beat up in 3 out of 4 fights. And the fourth fight was a lackluster draw with a guy that's always, you know, been, you know, a decent fighter, nothing great. So, you know, well, so Mosley stepping in with Amir Khan. So, you know, for Mosley, it's like, well, nobody's expecting him to win, but he's in there against a fighter that, yeah, he's quick and he has good power, but he's also, you know, he's got a chin that, you know, guys with glass chins, Glass Joe from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out would say that Amir Khan has a glass jaw. So there's a chance, you know, that Mosley, you know, could land a shot and outgo the lights.
Well, Amir Khan is built like a lightweight too. He's not really.
He's a quick guy, and he's got decent power, but he's not physically imposing. He's not a guy that's going to muscle you around the ring. He's not a guy that's going to rough you up. And you figure he's not Mayweather quick. He's not Pacquiao quick. And at the same time, he's not, you know, Canelo, you know, bull power strong. So he's a smaller version of like Sergio Mora. Maybe a little quicker, maybe he hits a little bit harder, but he's that same, you know, physical build. And that's a guy that, you know, Mosley, he has a legitimate shot against. If he wins, great, you know, and it gets his name out there some more. If he loses, what are you expecting him to win anyway?
Right.
Remember, he was a guy that was winning for his Valco 10 years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah, there you go. Another.
You know, I segued right back to the PEDs.
Exactly. Yeah, he's one of those suspected cheaters. I don't know if he ever tested positive for anything, but you know, he's got the kind of court of public opinion against him and that whole thing. I know Floyd Mayweather loves to mention it every chance he gets. So you know, that's kind of the way that combat sports deals with it. They just kind of you know, give somebody the bad reputation, but they don't necessarily take action against them a lot of these times. So anyway, sticking to the boxing, but getting into a little MMA stuff too, I had a look at an interesting article today that mentioned that Holly Holm, when she walked away from boxing, according to Mike Winklejohn, she turned down $250,000 because she wanted to do MMA. So she had a lot of six-figure offers to continue her boxing career, but turned them all down to go after MMA. And who knows, it might pay off, because as Ronda Rousey's finding out, she's getting movie deals out of it, and, you know, she's actually on the cover of the magazine I just wrote an article for, Ultimate MMA Magazine, even though I don't have an article with her. She's got a Zion sponsorship, boo-hoo. Or boo, I should say. and she's doing good. And she's a big media icon, and She's got a big fight coming up in December. And Holly Holm is obviously trying to get to that point where she could fight Rousey or could get into the UFC. But right now she's kind of cruising through the Legacy Fighting Championships. Interestingly enough, too, the Ultimate MMA magazine has a big story this month on the whole boxing versus MMA debate. And some interesting figures in here about the pay-per-views. And mainly shows that boxing beats MMA in pay-per-view. They use 2012 statistics, but doesn't really mention anything about 2013. But it does show, let me see if I can find the numbers in here, got right here. It does show that they've got a lot better numbers with the boxing than the MMA. I think it was like a couple fights in 2012 got over a million pay-per-view buys for boxing, but in MMA, it's, I think the closest one was 900,000. Where is this article? Okay. Here it is. So, 2012 pay-per-view statistics, boxing, Mayweather versus Cotto had 1.5 million buys. Pacquiao versus Marquez had 1.15 million buys. And Pacquiao versus Bradley had 700,000 buys in pay-per-view. UFC 148 in 2012, Sonnen versus Silva, had 925,000 buys, and that was the most popular MMA event of that year as far as pay-per-view buys. Then we had UFC 145, Jones versus Evans, had 700,000 buys, and also UFC 154, St. Pierre versus Condit, had the same amount of buys. But this is actually probably the most in-depth article I've ever seen on, you know, different perspectives on boxing and MMA. They actually get a lot of quotes from some interesting people. Amir Khan is in here. He says, "I enjoy watching MMA and know how dedicated those guys are to their craft. I don't see MMA as a threat to boxing. Boxing has been around for a long time, and there have always been people who have said that the sport is nearing its end. When you look at the sport today, there are so many young, exciting fighters coming through." Ricky Hatton is quoted here. "I'm a fan of MMA. I've been to some of the UFC shows in Las Vegas. The production is top class with interviews before the fight shown on screens and rock music playing. I appreciate boxing, but I'm starting to learn more about the technical stuff when they're on the floor." Felix Sturm says, "I've always been a big fan of MMA. All MMA fighters have my utmost respect for their courage and fighting spirit. You have to be a good wrestler. You have to box. You have to kick, have stamina, and be tough. So after all, I'm glad I became a boxer." They've got quotes from Mickey Rourke in here. You know, overall, it's a pretty decent article. But anyway, speaking of pay-per-view, the Bellator deal has been in the news this week with Tito Ortiz and Quentin Rampage Jackson sort of making the circuit here. The UFC has a little bit of a world tour going on. This is like the hater tour for the UFC with Jackson and Tito Ortiz. They just had a conference call, and both of them were quick and lengthy at blasting the UFC's treatment of their fighters. And, you know, obviously you wonder how many fighters that are in the UFC want to say the stuff that these guys are saying, but because they have ties to the company and they're under contract and they probably signed agreements saying that they can't really badmouth it too much, you know, they're quiet, but Tito Ortiz and Rampage Jackson, their comments are, I mean, as much as I don't like the UFC's behavior in certain situations, their comments are starting to get pretty old at this point. But they refuse to stop bashing the company. And my perspective is, like, I appreciate that they're, you know, their opinions from being in the company and from dealing with it firsthand, but at the same time, it would make a lot more sense if you'd say, oh, well, I appreciate what they did for me to put me on the map, but, and then come out with the stuff. But they're acting like, you know, the UFC never did a damn thing for them to get them where they are. And that's just not true. But at the same time, the other part of it for me is I used to be a salesman when I graduated from college. I sold truck accessories, and I was in a car sales program for a little while. I even did direct door-to-door business sales for Verizon. So one of the main principles of sales is you're not supposed to badmouth the competition. That shouldn't be your main selling point. And here these guys are trying to sell the first pay-per-view event for Bellator, and all they can do is badmouth the competition. why don't you highlight what you've got to bring to the table? And, you know, it's kind of, to me, it kind of makes the UFC look superior when the first pay-per-view event here for Bellator is only put together because you got two stars that came from the UFC to put it on and to be in the main event. And that's probably, you know, the biggest compliment I'll give to the UFC, but it's
well,
true.
And as you would say about the psychology of the whole thing, that's like you keep talking about your ex-girlfriend. What about your new one? I mean, how long are you going to last with your new one if you can't get over your past one? You see what I mean? That's what it sounds like to me. It's like, come on, guys, you got something positive going here. And make the most of where you're at.
Exactly. And I think I'm probably going to write something about this for rantsports.com, their MMA section there, one of these days, probably tomorrow or over the weekend. But, you know, there's been some mixed reactions to them, to Bellator signing these guys to wrestling contracts, too. Tito Ortiz just appeared on TNA Wrestling. And Rampage Jackson is obviously going to be part of the organization. He had his little face-to-face with Kurt Angle already. And obviously King Mo had a whole documentary, and he's already involved with TNA Wrestling. And it's kind of one of those attractive things that Bellator is using to lure some of these guys into big-time contracts with Viacom and Bellator, basically. It's one of the advantages that they have. But at the same time, I wonder, you know, is that the only thing that got these guys to sign this deal? Is that your only blue-chip, you know, piece of bait there that you're bringing to the table to get these guys on board? And why should these guys have to, you know, be multi-sport athletes here? I guess if you consider wrestlers, pro wrestlers, athletes. I know it's from the descriptions that King Mo's provided, it's definitely a rough life to do both. And, you know, it's not as easy as it looks with the pro wrestling and jumping around and the body slamming and all that. You know, it's a painful business.
Yeah.
But
I know people who are pro wrestlers, and they told me, you know. You know, it's funny, back maybe 12 or so years ago, 15 years ago, when they were having Monday Night Wars between WWF at the time and WCW, and they were battling over the ratings and all that. And, you know, and it was really getting violent at the time, you know, a lot of chair shots, a lot of really violent angles. And he, like, I forget who said it, but he said, you know, when you're growing up, you know, everybody used to make fun of wrestling. When wrestling tried to portray itself as a sport, everybody said it was fake. When they came out and said, you know, we're not a sport, we're sports entertainment, they were criticized for being too violent.
Mm. Right. So the bottom line is, you know, Bellator has a novelty that these other fight organizations just can't touch. But at the same time, if they really want to compete with the UFC and they really want to do a lot more pay-per-views and make more money in different avenues, they ought to just put the bulk of this Viacom corporation that owns them behind the signings. And they ought to just sit there and look at every UFC contract they can get a hold of and find out exactly when the thing is up and start talking to these guys and start luring the bigger names that are current superstars, not just fading, you know, past superstars. Not that Rampage and Tito are not capable of, you know, still fighting at the top level, but you know, there has been in a lot of people's eyes and a lot of fans' eyes. They've lost the bulk of their last few fights. Rampage left the UFC after losing 3 fights in a row. And Tito Ortiz was like 1-7 in his last 8 fights in the UFC. So if they really want to make a big statement, you know, it's not going to be by taking guys that the UFC doesn't want and trying to build them into your new stars. It's going to be taking the UFC's current stars away from them. And I'd like to see them try to do a little bit of that. I know that, you know, it's not really Bjorn Rebney's style, the CEO of Bellator, to go out there and, you know, badmouth the competition and talk trash. He didn't even mention in the press conferences and calls and stuff about the fact that these guys were ex-UFC fighters. It's these guys that are doing it, and he's just kind of letting it happen. But it goes to show you exactly how bitter they are by when you listen to some of the comments that they're making in these interviews and these conference calls. And here's something from Tito right here. He says, right now it's about making history. It's about making another brand. It's about a company that I put my hard work of 15 years into that just pretty much shut me out and turned me down. Now I'm with another one, and I'm going to do exactly the same thing with a positive environment around me. I think fighters in general need another opportunity instead of just answering to one man, to be able to have an opportunity to look somewhere else. People want to be treated right as fighters. We should be respected as fighters. Fighters that want to be treated right, they come to Bellator. So there you go. And the same type of stuff was coming out of the mouth of Rampage Jackson, too. And by the way, Rampage, like I said last week, has not ruled out the fight with Roy Jones Jr. And he basically blamed Tito Ortiz signing with Bellator for screwing that up. So it wasn't just rumors and
hearing all this makes me wonder if Bellator wants to compete with the UFC along those lines, or if they just want to be something different with so much more novelty. I don't know. I mean, I haven't thought about it that much until we've talked about it tonight. But maybe they're looking for a whole separate thing.
Right. But Tito's probably gone further than Rampage in his criticism. And he's actually kind of made it seem like the negativity that was surrounding him in the UFC was the whole reason why he wasn't successful there. Which is, you know, I guess in some ways makes a little bit of sense, but, you know, it's a little ridiculous when you consider that, you know, a fighting career is way more about skills than it is about your mental perspective is obviously important, but, you know, it's not, doesn't fly with me when you blame everything on.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a stretch. I think if he felt that he was being treated wrong, I think you could channel that into motivating yourself to perform better. So, I mean, I don't know. It sounds like a stretch to me.
But, you know, they do both make some good points about Dana White. You know, obviously, I have no real respect for a guy who never fought a day in his life and, you know, just doesn't seem to have any respect for the guys that lined his pockets with all the money that he has these days. But at the same time, you know, the guy has some good points about Bellator and the way they're operating and how that, you know, they've basically set the foundation for pay-per-views and MMA. And you know, they're going to have to do a lot better than putting Tito and Rampage in these headlining fights. They're going to have to build a lot more stars. And one of the things that they did mention this last week is that Michael Chandler will be also featured in that first pay-per-view. And that's really one of their biggest stars, so that'll help. But anyway.
You know, Rich, one last thing before we move on. You were talking about Holly and the offer she had just to continue boxing. Now, assuming you're her manager, do you think it would be possible for her to do both sports? What do you think?
Well, yeah, she could definitely do both sports, but if her goal is to fight Ronda Rousey, she shouldn't be used to doing that. She shouldn't be in that position where she's always trying to do both, because the UFC is not going to let her do that if they sign her.
That's a good point.
Right now, the UFC has kind of a loose arrangement with Invicta, where some of the fighters cover that on Invicta cards. And when they were in charge of Strikeforce, they had a situation where they allowed their fighters to still compete in other organizations because they were under contract with Strikeforce, which allowed that. But, you know, now that they're a whole, you know, separate entity, and they've just kind of signed some fighters over from there, they've gone back to that whole idea that you can't do anything else. I mean, Ronda Rousey, I think, is lucky that she's able to do the movies, because I think if they could prevent that, they would.
Yeah.
But they're very exclusive with their contracts, so I think that Holly Holm just wants to dedicate all her time to MMA, and she doesn't want to let boxing kind of blur the lines, where if, you know, she's going to get to be at a point where she's superior to all the other females in the business like she wants to be, she knows that, you know, she can't confuse the two sports at all. And she has to devote herself wholly to one, which I think is a good move. I mean, I don't really see anybody that's had major success doing both at the same time.
Well, that's my point, because she'd have to make some boxing modifications for MMA, but more important, worry about, you know, you really dedicate herself to the ground game, dedicate herself to Muay Thai. I mean, there's so many other aspects. It would be challenging to do both, but it was kind of an interesting thought, you know, just, but because I know at one point Mark Coleman said he wanted to, when he was on his role back in the UFC, back in the 90s, he still wanted to try to make the 2000 Olympic team.
Right.
But then he saying it was one thing.
Too. I mean, you've got Rampage Jackson, who's probably one of the oldest MMA fighters, talking about going into boxing. But he's even pointed out that he might be willing to fight Kimbo Slice and talk about setting that up. And Kimbo Slice has gone from backyard boxing to MMA and then back to regular boxing. So I know we haven't heard much about him lately, but he's kind of been more of a circus freak than anything in the boxing world. But, you know, he's proven that he can be a draw. And he's making money at it, obviously. But it's tough for these guys to go back and forth, and ladies too. But if anything, I think kickboxing is a lot better sport to do if you're in MMA and you want to do two sports, because guys like Alistair Overeem have been able to do both, and he's done well with it. And, you know, obviously it's probably because he was doing some testosterone. But
do you think?
But he's done well with it, and I think anybody that is a good enough athlete can do both. But I just think in her perspective, she probably is sick of boxing and considers that her career has already proven everything she's going to prove in that sport. So now she's trying to just go for a new challenge every day and trying to just immerse herself in everything that is MMA. So we'll see how that works out for her, but I think she's got the skills to get all the way. Anyway, let's get to this performance-enhancing drug thing. In the past, we've done this segment called TNT. We did the intro music and everything, but you know, we can still call it TNT, but without the music. That's for Tom and Tony. So we're going to have you guys kind of discuss this. With this particular towards each sport. This all stems from, of course, like I said earlier, Alex Rodriguez being popped for being involved with this Biogenesis company down there in Miami, Florida. And that's a convenient place because a lot of these spring training camps are down there in Florida. And so it's gotten a big focus with the baseball circles because of the way the Major League Baseball management has cracked down on these guys. 15 total players were disciplined. The minimum was 50 games, I believe. suspensions. And for a lot of those guys, that's half a year. In MMA circles, it's pretty much the same thing when you get popped. But boxing commissions are really, Dana White and other people have pointed out, promoters have pointed out, boxing promoters have said that it's the government that tests these guys. It's not us. So what is up with that? So you never see a guy like Lou DiBella come in and suspend a fighter because he suspects or has done an investigation that proves a guy has done steroids. It's these boxing commissions. And a couple of these articles that have been written about this has shown that these guys just don't have the budget in these boxing commissions across the country to even test people. And the testing is very expensive. The World Anti-Doping Agency is pretty much the primary company that does it when fighters pay out of pocket. But some of these organizations, the boxing commissions, they have like $10,000 a year to pay for that type of stuff, and that's just not going to cut it for most of these fighters. So it's a big problem. But one fighter that has come out in connection with this biogenesis is Euriorcus Gamboa. And according to the details, it's pretty disturbing what his program included, allegedly, I guess you'd say. But the guy who ran the clinic said told the New York Times, or the New Times, I guess, Miami New Times, that Gamboa had an extensive program that included a six-day-a-week HGH regimen, IGF-1, which is a human growth hormone-like substance that's said to boost strength and endurance, and a cream with, get this, 20% testosterone. Now, I've seen commercials with 1.62% testosterone cream that has a buttload of side effects, so I can't imagine 20% testosterone is even safe. But that's what he supposedly was doing. So, you know, granted, they do mention that he didn't have any type of fight coming up. Nobody really wanted to fight him at that point, and it was all for training. But that's what these guys are getting away with the testosterone treatment for, is training. And that's what makes it so such a complicated issue and such an unfair advantage, because really, it's the training that gets you ready for the fight. And if you can train at an astronomical level, you're going to fight the same way, whether you're on the stuff still or not. You're going to have the muscles and you're going to have the build that training produced in you. So it's still unfair to, you know, fighting, especially when you're fighting a guy that didn't have that advantage in training. So.
Or I'd like to make a counterpoint to that. And obviously, I'm going back. You know, about 20 or so years ago, this is obviously, it's a competitive sport, but it's not a contact sport. In fact, it's you know, only certain people could ever really get into this. But it's bodybuilding, and I know guys that were professional bodybuilders. I worked with a guy, and when he showed a picture when he first started, he was 18 years old. He looked like he was all 12. You know, he was short anyway. He was like 5'4", 5'5", skinny, about 110 pounds. He's posing, doing like a flex pose, and he looked like a little kid. Then he's like, okay, this is about a year or so later with, like, you know, a high-protein diet and, like, working out, like, so many hours a day. And it looked like he literally superimposed his face on, like, Schwarzenegger's body. So he was that huge. And I was like, that cannot be natural. And then another guy that I know that actually emailed me tonight, we're still friends, he used to work out with him, and he said, this guy, I'm not going to mention any names, but he said his downfall, like in his bodybuilding, was always his calves. So he used to inject the steroids directly into his calves. Now, like I said, I don't know much about bodybuilding. I really don't know much about lifting. But I remember reading an article about this one bodybuilding federation that was trying to get cracked down on steroids about 20 or so years ago. And these guys, you know, they were training on the steroids. And obviously they're getting the results then and there. But when they, for these competitions, were trying to beat the tests and, you know, getting off the steroids, granted that, yeah, you got the advantage during, say, the 3 months that you trained on the steroids, but then your body went into withdrawal, and it actually, like, would start, like, all those effects that you had would, you know, not blow up in your face, but you would lose them, and it was a huge, like, shrink, like, really right in front of your own eyes. So, you're like, and like I said, I'm no expert, I'm no kinesiology expert, I'm no biology network or biotechnology or whatever you call that. But, yeah, say you train, like, say you and I are going to fight, and you train for months on a steroid, yeah, you were getting great results during that, say, 3 months of training. But say for that fourth month, you got off of it to beat the test, I think that can actually do maybe more damage in the long run. Because now it's like you're taking away, you know, your best advantage, and something that you were so used to, now that you don't have it, you might really actually, your performance would be less than mine. If I was training legit, you were way ahead of me. Now you end up way below me. Like, so that's just my theory on it. And open the debate.
Well, I get that, and that's probably one of the reasons why a lot of the guys that have been popped in MMA have lost their fights that they were tested positive for. So that does happen, I'm sure, but at the same time, you know, there's a reason why some of this stuff is designed the way it is, to get past the tests or to make it so that, you know, it's much less pronounced. It's not your traditional steroid type of stuff. It's an unfair advantage, but it's not like the type of stuff that's going to be noticed. You know, it's like a lot of these guys in MMA, they're using the testosterone replacement therapy to overcome injuries, so they get back to the game quicker than somebody who gets injured and has to go the natural route. So they're basically like Alex Rodriguez and all these baseball players. They're making money because they've used these drugs and these substances. And even when Alex Rodriguez was dodging questions about this, what did he say? He said, you know, I've been through hell because I've had all these injuries. So he's obviously using it, has been using it for that purpose too, to overcome all these injuries. And he didn't really say it outright, but that was his excuse, I think. And a lot of these guys are falling on that excuse that, you know, it's not really giving them advantage because they're doing it for injuries, but it's obviously giving them an advantage over a guy that's not having access to that stuff and has to overcome an injury naturally. And then they end up making more money because they're back in the game sooner.
I remember a couple of years ago, a guy like James Lights Out Tony, and he got pinched. And he, I think he like hurt a bicep or a shoulder or whatever. And he was on something doctor prescribed. So this is like a gray area. Doctor, you know, gave him this or whatever. And then I think it's when he fought John Ruiz back in 2005. And he beat Ruiz, wins that fight, and then he gets pinched for this steroid substance. And the fight becomes a no contest. He gets stripped of the title. And James came out and he goes, look at me. Does it look like I take steroids? now, there's got to be more of a gray area here when you're right, coming back from injury. Because if you're on something that a doctor, a medical physician is prescribing you, then you should not get pinched for that. That is prescribed by a... I mean, now granted, on the flip side of that, like you can, like a lot of these guys would, and I'll give you once again another example from the pro wrestling days of the 80s. There was a doctor that used to work all the WWF shows, Dr. George Zaharian. And he was known as like the steroid doc. The guys would go to him and he would get them steroids. He prescribed them steroids. And then when they were trying to, you know, when the feds were looking to bust Vince McMahon in the early 90s, he's trying to get rid of this guy Zaharian. And even the secretaries are like, you know, we don't want you around. We don't want you coming to any of the shows anymore, you know. And he would still try to get in. And and then he would get guys his personal number, and they would come to him personally in his own office trying, you know, to get steroids. So if you get a friendly doctor, quote-unquote, okay, yeah, he's going to prescribe these things to you. So, that, yeah, that's a touchy area. I mean, if you're legit injured and the doc legit prescribes you something, shouldn't be a penalty for that. But at the same time, if you get one of these, quote-unquote, friendly docs, then it is illegal. So I can see where the basis is here. It's like they're just coming out and saying, fuck it, it's all illegal. You know, because I guess they can't prove if it's a legit prescription or not anymore.
Well, there's
believe me, these guys got enough money that, you know, they can make these docs friendly very quickly.
Right. Well, there's a couple of flip sides to this, too, because, number one, you have situations where this stuff, over time, you do too much of it, and it's like these guys can get TRT applications approved in some circles, but they can't in others, because a guy like Vitor Belfort, he can't fight in Nevada and get a TRT exemption because he's been popped for steroids before. So the accusation is, well, you only need TRT because you have a condition that was caused by you taking too many steroids. And then the other side of it is, well, all these athletic commissions and the organizations themselves, like the UFC and Bellator, they don't want to catch people. Even though Dana White says that, you know, that's how they make their money, by popping people and fining them and stuff. At the same time, they're not going to get their licensing fees if they pop too many people. They're not going to get their state's not going to get the revenue from staging events if they have to cancel something because the guy gets popped. You know, sometimes if a main event fighter gets popped, they have to cancel the whole card. I mean, look at Alistair Overeem's situation. Yeah, they did the random drug testing on him and they caught him, but an event had to get canceled. So it's a real catch-22 for a lot of these people. And it's not, I mean, a lot of people criticize the boxing commissions and combat sports in general for not being as rigorous in tracking this stuff down as the Major League Baseball teams. But Major League Baseball is a team sport. You can have a guy out for the season and the team can still go on. And every game will still happen as planned. But in MMA and boxing, that's not the same thing. It's so different. And even when they do find out a guy has done performance-enhancing drugs according to the rules that are in place in combat sports, all they can really do is deny a license unless a guy is actually physically caught in a test where they can suspend him and fine him. All they can do is really deny a license. That's one of the article's points that I sent you guys. So it's something that you wonder, you know, do they really want to change? And if so, how do they change it? And obviously that's one thing that boxing and MMA share is that they're both individual sports, which are all really built around a main event. So if you end up testing every fighter on a card and a main event fighter gets popped but nobody else does, you could still end up having the whole card get canceled.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, say, for example, and obviously I'd be willing to bet a lot of money that the fighter I'm about to bring up is going to be the last guy to really get pinched. Say, for example, Mayweather gets pinched for steroids. And I say that because he's the one that is such a big advocate of drug testing. But say he gets pinched, and now he gets this fight with Canelo. What's likely going to happen, say that whole fight gets, that fight gets scrubbed. Well, you know you're not going to get a $70 or a $60 pay-per-view for a fight that's going to be very good like Danny Garcia and Lucas Matisse. So what you might end up having is Matisse and Garcia become a main event, but not of that pay-per-view card. They might become a small pay-per-view card, maybe like a $30 pay-per-view card, or they're going to be a Showtime fight because they're not going to bring in the Mayweather money.
Right. Well, the only way to change this, I think, is one of two ways. You either find a way to make sure that these athletic commissions do have the money to do the testing, or you put more pressure on the promoters to provide the money for the testing. Some of them are doing it. There's some mentions in these articles about, you know, both fighters and promoters getting involved in setting the testing up. I think Johnny Hendrick and George St. Pierre are scheduled to do the WADA testing for their next fight. So it does happen where these guys reach into their own pockets and get it done. But when everybody isn't doing it, and it's not even guys that are even in any whispers about doing it that are taking steps, it really doesn't do much to help the situation. But I just think that you have to have a level playing field in the sport where it's the object to knock the other guy out, which can cause serious injury. And, you know, not to mention broken bones in MMA where guys are, you know, just got the whole gamut of options in fighting. So it's definitely, I think, more important than a lot of people make it out to be. But at the same time, I think a lot of these guys find it convenient that they can either say, well, the promoter should do more, or, well, the government should do more of these commissions. And then you have these commissions that they're different everywhere you go. Like with the UFC, when they have to go overseas to fight, they have fight cards, they're responsible for testing their own fighters, which doesn't make any sense to me, but...
No, I know they've made improvements in the sport of boxing. I mean, back in the day, every commission was almost, like, separate. So it's like you could fight in California under one set of rules, then go fight in Nevada under another set, then fly to New York and fight under a third set. So now they're using more unified rules. So a lot of times it's... I remember watching all the title fights. Okay, hey, we're in this like WBC middleweight championship. We're fighting under the WBC rules, which means no standing eight count. Three knockdown rule is in effect. This and like whatever else rule. Then you have an IBF title fight. It's like, well, there is no standing eight count. There is no three knockdown rule. Only the referee can stop the fight. So now they're going to more unified rules, which is great. Because I think boxing needs a national commission, because you have weak states. You know, you have your big states, your Californias, your Nevada, especially Nevada, your New Jerseys, your Pennsylvania, your New Yorks, where you get a lot of major fights and a lot of major title fights. But then you get weak commissions. You get, like, your Louisianas. You get your Oklahomas. You get, like a lot of your Midwest states. That have like really shitty commissions, and it's, you know, what's happening there is like they don't have the funding to do the testing, or you have to sit like, okay, take a fighter out there, take a guy like Shane Mosley. You know, Shane Mosley, say he fails a drug test. You know, he's coming back to fight Amir Khan, and he fails a drug test in the state of Nevada, and Nevada bans him, or they suspend him. Well, back in the day, okay, he's suspended in Nevada. He would just run to California and get a license, or he'd run to, like, Oklahoma and get a license, or New Jersey and get a license. And now it's like, if you're suspended, you're suspended. You're suspended one place, you're pretty much suspended everywhere, and I believe that also includes overseas. So it's like the national commission, maybe not because it is a national commission, but... at least they're making some uniform statement here, so to avoid, you know, just what would happen back in the day. I know it's like sometimes if a fighter was, maybe he was fighting in Pennsylvania, and I was at a fight one time, and the guy, he was a tough kid, but he was taking a lot of beatings, and I'd seen him fight three or four times, and he was getting beat up, and he was losing the fights pretty bad. I remember after the fight, Greg Serb, who was the Pennsylvania commissioner, I remember sitting there for a conversation between them and Greg saying, listen, kid, I can't in good conscience give you a license anymore. He's like, you're taking too much of a beating in your last few fights, and it's hazardous to your health. And, he's like, I can't license you. Now, this kid, back in the day, was... well, fuck it, I can't get in Pennsylvania, I'm just going to run to West Virginia. Like, weak commission.
Yeah, look at Antonio Margarito. And he was suspended.
Absolutely.
State. Just went to Texas. His license. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's so splintered.
And I remember Tommy Morrison. Remember when Tommy Morrison was suspended because of his HIV situation? And then he was licensed in West Virginia about 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was just a one-fight thing, and then I never heard anything more about it. But I think that's over with now.
I think it was over in Japan, wasn't it?
Him
and
well,
Foreman
that's
one on the same card. Was it
yeah,
Japan
that's
or China?
That was
back, no, it was over.
Right. Well, that was back in the '90s when he went initially.
96.
Right. That was right after he was knocked out by Lennox Lewis, and I think it was his next fight.
Yeah.
And then he was overseas. But I'm talking about like maybe 6-7 years ago. I'd have to Google it, but well, I can do that now, I guess. But I know that he had a fight in West Virginia, and he won by, I think, a third-round knockout. But then I just never heard anything else from him again, and maybe that's over with now. But that was the only state, I guess,
actually,
he could get a license in.
I actually got some messages from his his lawyer and manager at the time. I forget the guy's name, but he sent me some emails about it because I had something on the blog about that whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he claimed that he beat the disease. That, you know, he has no traces of it in his system. So he was actually able to legitimately pass the test. Now, I haven't heard any confirmation of that, but they were going around saying that for a while, and nobody ever stepped in and showed a test that proved them wrong. So
here's what I remember the situation. And I said, yeah, I remember Tom saying it was about a good 5 or 6 years ago at least. And,
February 22nd, 2007. He won a second-round TKO against a fellow by the name of John Castle at Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort, Chester, West Virginia. He had one more fight February 9th, 2008, against Matt Weishar in Guanajuato, Mexico, which he won by TKO, looks like, in the third round. Yeah. Okay.
Now, for what I remember off the top of my head about the situation, I remember the night that he was fighting, the first fight down in West Virginia, that fight was aired. It was aired on, like, not an ESPN, but maybe like a sports network. I don't remember off the top of my head. But they refused to air his fight. They would only show still pictures, which was unusual. And, yeah, Rich was right, because I remember they were saying, like, he beat the disease, he had no traces of it. And, of course, they obviously were going to make him go in for extensive blood testing. But part of the controversy was something about the blood, and I forget if they were saying that the blood was taken in a lab, like maybe say in like California, but it was, like, analyzed in another state. And then there was no proof that it was actually his blood. So now you had a situation where you're looking at possibly blood switching. I remember hearing about that. And then I remember after the fight was over, I remember his lawyer wouldn't let him answer any questions with regards to the HIV. When they interviewed him after the fight, like I said, it's just confirmed it was only a 2-round fight. And the first round, the guy who was like, Owen, was beating him up pretty good. And then Morrison caught him with his big left hook, knocked him out. And when he went to interview him, he had a mouse under his one eye, and he was huffing and puffing. I mean, you could tell he was out of breath. And as
right.
part of the interview, all he could talk about was the fight. Nothing about the blood, nothing about the HIV. And like I said, they didn't even air the fight. It was like shown in still pictures. And then, yeah, I remember he fought again like a year or so later, and that was another fight that he won. Then I know he took some mixed martial arts fights, and the one fight he did on mixed martial arts, because Rich and I talked about it on the air, because by this time I was doing the show, and it was a mixed martial arts fight with boxing gloves and, like, punches only. It was literally a boxing match, saying it was mixed martial arts, and he won that. But and the last I remember hearing was Rich sent me an article about a year or two ago and saying, do you recognize this guy? And I said, shit, that looks like Tommy Morrison, but only like, he looked like Randy Couture. He had like his shaved head, his skin looked almost leathery, he looked bad. And look at Connie Morrison, but only like 70 years old. And it's like, oh shit, it is. And it was after a, I forget if it was a DUI or a drug possession.
Yeah, that MMA fight was at an Indian reservation, too.
Once again, a place where there's very, where there's next to no commission.
But, yeah, I got a lot of stuff back here from 07 on Morrison. Definitely a controversial issue there.
Very.
Supposedly, yeah, he said he beat it, but I don't know. I never really heard much about anybody proving him wrong on that one.
I'll never heard him about him proving it right, either.
Right.
Except that one blood test that
he's obviously still not fighting, so. But he's still alive.
He's still alive, but I don't know if there's legal trouble and problems with drugs and alcohol. And it's a shame, because I was always, I grew up a big Tony Morrison fan. I said my dad was watching him because I was a John Wayne's nephew thing. And my dad, you know, was always a big John Wayne fan. And then so I watched him a few times, and because my dad liked him, I liked him. And then the Rocky V thing, you know, I was like, oh my God, he's in Rocky V. So, you know, well, he's like my favorite fighter now. And I was a big Tony Morrison fan. I remember I was upset the night that Ray Mercer beat him. I was like 14 years old. I was pissed. Then we had Ray on a year or so ago, and he was hysterical about it. I was farting in the ring. He was hitting so hard, I was in there farting. Had to knock him out. You know, I was afraid I'd shit myself.
Yeah, it was Randy Lang, the lawyer. He actually commented on one of the stories that a guy named Charles Schmidt wrote for our site, apparently. But, yeah, pretty interesting story angle there. But anyway, on the whole subject of PEDs, kind of straying off subject there, it's definitely something that they should do more about. I don't think they will, but I think, you know, a lot of these promoters, boxing promoters and box and MMA promoters, they do have the authority to take action, especially the UFC, you know, who has already thrown out guys for comments. You know, public comments that they've made, Twitter comments, guys have been thrown out of the league. So I just think it's a matter of, you know, they don't want the headache. And Dana White has even come out flat out and said that. I don't want the headache that this Biogenesis thing is going to cause. So I just think that they could do a little bit more and they should do more to kind of police the sport and clean it up. And oddly enough, it's actually the union in baseball that's involved in trying to clean things up a little bit in that sport. So maybe a fighters union of some sort or an association that would lobby for that would be the answer. But something's definitely got to be done more than what's being done now, from my perspective. Tom, what's your take on this? We haven't heard much out of you.
Yeah, well, you know, just as a little attempt at humor, someone had made the comment, and there's been virtually all the news with all the main sports, you know, and so the talk shows around here, everyone's calling up, and they have this righteous indignation. Oh, as far as A-Rod, ban him for life. Make sure he's never in the Hall of Fame, and they want lifetime bans on all these guys. And someone made the comment that if you're a politician, it's okay to go ahead and cheat because there's not a politician alive that doesn't do that. And if some of this righteous anger was directed toward them for their cheating ways, maybe we'd have a little better society. You know, I know it's apples and oranges, okay? But I just found that kind of humorous because we hear lots of lies from both parties. I'm not being partisan here. But it just seems like the problem is almost insurmountable. I mean, I think you guys are a little more optimistic about it than I am, because I remember back in the California days and some of the bodybuilding gyms I was in, it seems like, now this was back in the 80s and steroids weren't the big deal that they are now. I don't even think they were a class one drug back then, if I remember right. I don't think that happened until the early 90s. I think Joe Biden was involved in that. But regardless, back then, it just seems like they were so free-flowing, and there were so many doctors that were willing, you know, for a variety of reasons, anything from money to some other darker activities. And these guys would brag about it, how they had so many doctors in their pocket. And I think that issue has to be addressed, because like we were saying earlier, it's a tough area. If a physician prescribes it, is the commission going to go against that? I mean, are we just going to give a blanket ban across? I mean, there's just so many problems. Then we get down to the finance. So I don't know. I mean, there's one part of me that agrees that, yeah, it's dangerous. It's dirty. It doesn't do anything good for any sport. But on the other hand, if it's chemical warfare, almost like professional bodybuilding, if you're not into chemical warfare, you're not going to be able to compete. So is it going to come down to everyone's got to do it? I mean, I'm just throwing this out, but I honestly don't know as far as an effective solution. I mean, with the financial constraints, with all these other things, it's a nightmare. To sum it up as best I can.
Football, even in the NFL football lockout, they had a situation where for at least a year they had nothing in place as far as human growth hormone. You know, no testing situation whatsoever for that. The year the lockout got broke and they started playing. And I think they just did it before last season, if I remember correctly, or maybe just before this season. They just finally made the changes that required testing for that. So there are some things that are kind of on the borderline that some sports are actually just kind of turning a blind eye towards on purpose. And this stuff, I guess, there is no proof that it's really that damaging to you. But at the same time, I just don't think it's fair to the people that are doing it naturally. I mean, obviously, it's their choice, and yeah, it's a situation where they feel if they don't do it, then they're not going to be able to make the kind of career that they need to make to feed their family.
I totally agree, and then. You know, like we were talking about the GSP and Hendrick both agreeing to it, but that's coming out of their pockets, but they're at the top levels of the game. And I'm thinking of all the small shows, how do we make it uniform? And, you know, the smaller promoters, I mean, we alluded to that earlier in our conversation. How do we do this? And then as far as the state athletic commissions, you know, there's all these budget cuts going on now, and it's tough to try to get more money for them. I mean, there's a whole, you know, the old cliche that the devil's in the details. And I would agree if we had these foolproof methods to just eradicate this stuff and get it the hell out of here. But I think the problem is just almost insurmountable. Now, I mean, hopefully I'll be proven wrong.
Yeah, it's a tough situation when you compare, you know, people try to compare it to, you know, that they don't care, but the UFC does, just because they're not like the MLB, they do test incoming fighters to make sure that whoever they sign is not on drugs at the time they sign them, at least. So if they do that, you'd think that they would care enough to test everybody randomly and to have a program where they randomly test fighters, but you know, they're in the business of making fights, so if they do too much to make fights impossible to happen, then it's going to hurt them in the long run. So it's a real catch-22.
Exactly, and then like Dana was quoted, hey, it's the government, man. They're tested by the government, man. That's what the government does. You remember all the quotes that he made on that? So you just have to wonder, of an organization that is paying the main event fighters in for world titles less than $50,000. If they're that stingy, are they going to come up with the money to do all this testing and cut into their profits? I mean, again, an open-ended question that I'd like to hear an answer to from, you know, somehow. But that's just another one of the problems.
Right. Well, it is what it is. I don't think it's a problem that's going to go away. I'm sure we'll discuss it at some other point down the line. I know that we've got a big Chael Sonnen controversy coming up in Boston where, you know, he's supposed to be fighting there on the August 17th card versus Shogun. And there's been some stories about him possibly not being approved, although I did see something that said that he was approved already. But, you know, this situation is going back and forth about that, and that's actually a legalized thing that they've actually gone ahead and provided an exemption program for that. So who knows whether we'll see this thing go in the opposite direction and there'll be human growth hormone exemptions.
Well, we're right back on that again. I mean, is that an unfair advantage for him? I mean, who's going to make that decision? Is it a physician that really understands the sport? And maybe you see what I mean?
Yeah. It's a very complicated thing, and you know, you can make cases for it both ways. We've kind of beat this one to death, but you know, my position stands that it should be something the promoters do more about, and maybe the government too. And they've got the legitimate structure in place to say, all right, well, promoters have to pay a certain fee for every fight to make sure that we do these random testings at least once during their training camp or something like that. You know, they've got to meet in the middle somewhere, I think.
I hear you, but I would just want to make sure that that's not going to drive some promotions over the edge, because you guys both know that this is a thin line in this business sometimes. You know, and I'm not talking about the mega fights. I'm talking about the smaller shows. It's a tough, thin line these promoters have to walk. And if the government's too heavy-handed and puts the whole ball in their court, there goes the whole show. So
right.
I know there has to be a middle ground. I don't know if I'm smart enough to tell you what it is, but I think you both would agree with me that we need to do something, but it can't swing too far. I mean, maybe a combined effort with the government and the promoters. But we're just not seeing that willpower at all levels like we need to, I think, you know. So.
Well, maybe a fighters union or something, an association that would push for that and raise money for that, for everything to change, and lobby the Congress or something to set aside money for that type of thing.
Where would the money come from? Where would the money come from, though? See, that's the whole question.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to put that one to bed on that note. We've got a couple other stories to cover here. And if you noticed, the commentary team was a little different for UFC 163 over the weekend. And a new announcer there, although he's kind of an old voice in the mix. It's been around a little while. It's Brian Stan. Was alongside Goldie there for the commentary team. And one guy who didn't appreciate it was Brandon Vera, according to this little piece here. He took to Twitter and was very critical of Stan's commentary. And it's interesting because he accused him of being unbiased when Brandon Vera is actually a training partner, teammate of Phil Davis. So he called Brian Stan out for not being unbiased enough in commentating on the Phil Davis fight. And he says, super awesome job, boss, about Phil, Mr. Wonderful there on Twitter. He says, you are the man. And he says, F you, Brian Stan. Learn how to be an unbiased commentator, bitch. Don't hate because he beat your ass, too. I don't know if that was called for at all. You know, I don't know if it's covered under the UFC's conduct policy, but I think that's out of line, especially when you're obviously biased.
maybe we can get Brian Stan to make a comeback here. We got a grudge fight, huh?
Right. But, you know, most of the people that I saw online commenting on that fight thought that Machida won and got screwed on that one, but. I don't fault Brian Stan for saying anything against Davis's effort there in that context, but it just blows my mind to see a guy call somebody biased when you're the teammate of the guy you're accusing the other guy of being biased against. So it is what it is, I guess, there. But Brian Vera, I don't think is the wisest guy in the world either. Now, this goes along some of the same lines as what we were just talking about. Of different boxing commissions with different rules and ways to get around this PED stuff and also other suspensions. here's a guy who, first of all, he beat a Mexican fighter in 30 seconds to win a European title. We've talked about that before, too, of, you know, white guys winning Mexican titles. But here's a white guy who fought for a European title against the Mexican guy. And not only that, but Craig Windsor Jr. here got a belt he gave himself. He created his own promotion, his own organization, because he was banned for steroids, actually. And he, this guy has got a pretty sordid past. He actually fled to Spain at one point after attacking a cocaine dealer and later got jailed. So now he says he created his own title, the European Boxing Foundation title. And the title is actually sanctioned by the Professional Boxing Organization, which he started himself when he was in Spain on the run from police. So he sanctioned his own fight, his own title, and fought a Mexican to get it. But this is actually pissing off the European Boxing Federation, who have accused this guy of hijacking their name. But they sent him a message and told him that he's not a member of the EBF and is not an EBF champion. And he then told them that he was. So they've asked him to stop using the initials EBF. But they've even pointed out, obviously, you would need to be European to win a European title, so a Mexican wouldn't be able to fight for it. But he was banned last year from boxing for 3 years and 9 months by the UK Anti-Doping Association. He's from Coatbridge, Lanarkshire, wherever the heck that is over there in the UK. But he's defending himself, saying they've got the wrong idea. I never said European Boxing Federation. They're the European Boxing Federation. And this was the European Boxing Foundation. My EBF is continuing to grow, and I'll be defending my title in September. Last year, actually, this guy was warned of 9 plots to kill him, and he's also received other similar threats. So obviously not a very well-liked guy in the first place. But anyway, just an interesting story of a guy that's been able to get around the whole issue of doping by literally doing his own thing. And, of course, last week we talked to Kathy Duva. We were able to salvage that interview for the website, fightradio.info, and the Blog Talk Radio platform there. But we haven't yet talked about the results of that event that we talked about. Curtis Showtime Stevens was in the main event there. And he took out Saul Roman at the 2 minutes, 26 second mark of the opening round to get the vacant NABF title in the main event there. And it was also actually co-promoted by Main Events and Jimmy Birchfield, Classic Entertainment and Sports, which is actually, I think, still Hank Lundy's promoter, if I remember correctly, as he changed promoters. Stevens dropped Roman early in the opening round, like Tony said, with a left hook, similar to the one that finished Connecticut's Elvin Ayala in the first round of their fight in January, also at Mohegan Sun. Asked if he'd campaign for a showdown against unbeaten World Boxing Association middleweight champion Gennady Golovkin. Stevens wouldn't take the bait, instead promising to train and do what I have to do to take over the middleweight division. And, of course, Golovkin has a 27-0 record and had a win over Matthew Macklin back in June. And Stevens did say, Gennady scored an excellent knockout and he's a great fighter, but he fought a scared fighter. So I guess that says something. Anyway, Thomas Adamek, fighting out of Jersey City, inched closer to a possible showdown against top-ranked heavyweight, following a big decision over Dominic Nguyen. Falls to 34-10-1. Adamek goes up to 49-2, so he's looking for his 50th win in his next fight. He won by a wide margin on this card, 99-91 twice and 98-92 once. And Gwynn replaced Tony Grano of Hartford, who was forced to withdraw 2 weeks ago due to a neck injury. But he lasted the whole fight and at least kept Adam Akronik's toes, according to this report. So we'll see what's next for him. And in the first of the three televised bouts, South African cruiserweight Tabiso Mchunu made an impressive debut on U.S. soil, dominating Eddie Chambers, 36-4 of Philadelphia, in a 97-93 and two-time 99-91 unanimous decision win. The shorter and more muscular Mchunu put on a boxing and footwork clinic against a surprisingly slow Chambers, picking his spots and using an effective right jab, overhand left combo to continuously stop Chambers dead in his tracks. And according to Mchunu, he said, Eddie is a very, very good fighter, but I knew he wasn't faster than me and wasn't stronger than me. And this was Chambers' first foray into the cruiserweight division after losing to Adamek in June of 2012. But obviously wasn't very successful there. In the opening bout of the night, unbeaten light middleweight prospect Tony Harrison of Detroit remained unbeaten with an impressive second-round knockout win over Camden, New Jersey veteran Gilbert Alex Sanchez. I don't know why they're calling him a veteran. He's only 2-3. But Harrison improves to 14-0 with 11 knockouts. And Long Island southpaw Michael Brooks also remained unbeaten, outworking the scrappy Chip Perez, 10-3 of Hartford, Connecticut, to earn a 57-56, 59-54, and 60-53 unanimous decision win. And we also had a fight between unbeaten Ukrainian heavyweight Vyacheslav Glazkov, who improved to 15-0-1 with 11 KOs over Byron Polly, who's 25-16-1. That fight ended in less than two rounds. And Polly outweighed Glazkov by more than 30 pounds, believe it or not. So that's about it there. Good card all around. Let's see, what else do we got here? David Tua is in the news. He's about to have a big fight against Russian Alexander Ustinov on August 31st at the end of the month. He just had a media appearance where he was wearing black latex gloves so he wouldn't get sick. Afraid of getting sick, whatever this was. But he was supposedly gone to hell and back to prepare properly for Ustinov. He's a pretty big guy with a fearsome 28-win, 1-loss record, and is managed by the Klitschko brothers. And his new sparring partner is Julius Long, who's from Detroit, and he's actually rumored to be the tallest current professional fighter in the world. 7'1" tall, and actually a little bit taller even than Ustinov. So Tua is 40 years old, but he looks fit and powerful, and looking forward to seeing how he does in his comeback here.
Boy, that body's a big target, huh?
Yeah.
Boy, I can get past that reach and work that body.
He says, I'm a guy who's always fought big guys. I'm in a weight division of giants, and I love it. The fact is, everyone refers this fight to the Lewis fight, Lennox Lewis, but for me, this is another fight, another day. And actually, his preparations with new trainer Dave Hitchcock have gone well, with Tua knocking out his previous sparring partner, Raymond Olubuwale, who's from Canada. Okay. Shaping up to be a pretty interesting fight. Tua is actually a guy, too, who trains has trained in the past at a place with that offers MMA, too, and he's worked with a lot of MMA guys, so it's going to be interesting to see if any of that training plays into his new comeback effort. speaking of comebacks, you get Julio Cesar Chavez Sr. in the comeback of sorts. He's going to be actually training his son for his fight again. Brian Vera. Yeah, Tony worried there. September 7th, that's going to be Cesar Chavez Jr.'s comeback fight against Brian Vera at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Chavez Jr. is 46-1-1 with 32 knockouts and is coming off a unanimous decision loss to Sergio Martinez from February. Then he's going with his father to be the head trainer for the Vera fight. And this is the first time in his son's 49 fights where his father is going to be involved. And I know that we had the situation where he was like father, like son situation. He got some substance abuse issues brought to light with a positive test of marijuana before one of his recent fights. And his father has actually had a real battle with substance abuse in his retirement that brought the two back together again. He says, the junior says, I told him, if you want to help me, do it formally, because if not, sometimes it just confuses my trainer. Chavez Sr. captured belts in three different divisions during his boxing career, and he's confident that his experience as a fighter will help his son become more successful in the ring. Chavez Sr. told ESPN, I believe I can help much more than down at ringside. He says I pressure him too much when I'm down there, and he says he feels the pressure. He says it's better for him that I'm in his corner. That way I can contribute more with my experience. But ESPN boxing analyst Brian Campbell believes the newly formed training relationship between father and son is a train wreck waiting to happen, pointing out the inherent vulnerability. Chavez Jr. was also criticized for his lax habit and lack of concentration during training, especially in the build-up heading into the fight with Martinez earlier this year. Chavez did not rule out a possibility of training with Boxing Hall of Famer Freddie Roach again, but for now his father will be the main tactician in his corner. And also on the boxing front, I think we talked a little bit about this last week or in previous weeks about some of the things that Mayweather has been saying about a potential Pacquiao fight. Mayweather would have to get Pacquiao to sign with his promotional team. But according to this piece, Manny Pacquiao still wants to go toe-to-toe with Floyd. And despite losing his last two bouts, Pacquiao called out the undefeated American when speaking to reporters at the Marina Sands, Mirror Bay Sands, on Friday. This was a couple Fridays ago, I think. And he basically said that he's making excuses. He says, I'm always open to fight with Floyd, but the problem is that he doesn't want to fight me. And he held a 15-bout win streak before his double defeats. But he says, Floyd keeps coming up with excuses like drug testing and how to split our money earnings. Let's just give the fans the fights they all want. I'm not sure that's accurate and all the fans want it. He's obviously got his own fight in front of him, and so does Floyd. So I don't think that fight's going to happen anytime soon, if it happens at all. But that's something that at least Manny still wants to. So we'll see what happens there. And we talked last week, I know, about a fight that I said was funny but not funny. With a couple guys planning a mixed martial arts fight. One of them had Down syndrome, or has Down syndrome. Yeah. And the other guy has cerebral palsy. Well, apparently someone else thought it was not funny, and they decided to stop the fight moments before it happened this last week. So that's in the news. I found it here. The father of one of the kids was pretty upset, according to this kid. Anyway, it was in Collier County, Florida. Just minutes before the match, the state stepped in and shut it down, claiming it was unsanctioned. And one of the fighters' father says it's discrimination. It was set to take place at the Seminole Casino in Immokalee. And it's something that both of these men told the the reporter on this piece on that was a dream come true. Now they're fighting to find a way back into the ring. It was a fight that was supposed to be the first of its kind, and Garrett Holev, 23, and David Steffen, 28, had been dreaming of the fight, but 5 minutes before the first punch, the state presented the promoter with a cease and desist letter. And Garrett's father, Mitch Holev, said he cried. It genuinely upset him. He's worked 8 weeks in training camp, training 4.5 hours a day for 8 weeks, getting mentally and physically prepared to do this. Garrett has Down syndrome, and his opponent, David, has cerebral palsy. The fight was supposed to happen because the match was being held on tribal land, but a letter from the state says the scheduled bout between the two amateur fighters is unsanctioned and against Florida law. The father says he's upset because he knows he's being told he can't fight because he has Down syndrome, and that hurts his feelings and that angers him. And a representative with the World Fighting Organization told Wink News that the safety of the fighters is our number one priority, and he doesn't think that the decision was made on the basis of discrimination but solely on fighter safety. Holev said his son got medical clearance and shows he was able to fight. I think their decision was pretty arbitrary and discriminatory, says Holev. We have two guys with disabilities, and we don't want them to fight here. That's his life, and they're stopping it. As his dad, I am just going to make sure that he can do it safely and his rights aren't infringed upon, and I'm not stopping anywhere until that happens. Holev is talking to the Boxing Commission, and he says he has also reached out to the National Down Syndrome Society. So hard to, for me to believe, at least, that the National Down Syndrome Society would advocate that fight to begin with. We'll see if anything happens there. Anyway, I mentioned a little bit earlier Rampage Jackson talking about the Roy Jones Jr. fight. Here's his exact quotes. Honestly, I think Tito fucked up that Roy Jones Jr. fight. The whole time I was getting ready to prepare for Jones, I was going to get down to 200 pounds. I was already setting up a boxing camp and everything. And then Tito signed to Bellator, and I thought, damn, there goes my Roy Jones fight. But I think the Jones fight will come around eventually after Tito and I fight. If everything goes according to plan, I'm sure that's a fight that will happen because Jones is very interested in fighting him.
Okay, now do we have any quotes from Roy Jones on this? Has he said anything publicly about it?
As I mentioned last week, he was at the stadium in the audience, in the front row, I think, or close to the front row, at the Bellator card where they announced the Tito fight, and there has to be a reason for that. I know that nothing came of it when he was at the Anderson Silva fight and there was talk of them two fighting, but we all know that Dana White does not like his fighters to do anything else but MMA, so
yeah,
I think that was just a courtesy thing there. But in this case, we know Bellator likes their fighters to do other stuff because they're doing wrestling. So I think that they will make this fight happen. I think it was part of Jackson's reasoning for coming over to Bellator because he would have the freedom to do this kind of stuff. And according to him, this is on his bucket list, having a boxing match, at least one. And he said, admitted that when he saw Kimbo Slice doing well after the UFC, he even considered a fight against him. And his words on that was, when I was voicing leaving the UFC and I wanted to box before I even signed with Bellator, I was being real. I wanted to box because I heard Kimbo was out there doing some boxing, was doing good. And I figured, hell, I'll box him. I just wanted to try boxing because if you think about it, I've done everything else. I've done jiu-jitsu at the beginning of my career, K-1, and I've done MMA. But boxing is the only thing I haven't done. I want to try it before I retire. It just played out the way it did. And then Tito came over and fucked all that up. If not Roy Jones Jr., it could be Kimbo Slice. But actually, I don't think Kimbo Slice would take that fight. Just don't think it would happen.
I think Roy would. Yeah.
Roy would definitely take.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have just shown up to a Bellator fight, having already talked about boxing an MMA guy, and not take that bait. He's looking for a statement fight, too, to end his career on. I don't think he wants to fight anybody with a overwhelming boxing record, but he'll take on a guy like Rampage, who's obviously at the end of his MMA career and has never done boxing before. So I think he'll cream Jackson, but Jackson has just enough balls and you know, cockiness to go ahead and sign on the dotted line to do it. And he's got a big name, so that'll be a great way for Jones to go out. And he'll prove a point that a lot of people have been waiting for a boxer to make, that most boxers could be that MMA fighter in the boxing game anyway.
Yeah, I think my money's on Roy on this one.
In a boxing match, yeah. I mean, you'd have to. You'd be foolish not to.
Right.
You take away a guy's three-quarters of his attack, and you put him up against there the guy who, yes, he's past his prime, and yes, he's not what he was 10, 12, you know, 15 years ago, but he's still exceptionally talented. He's still faster than, you know, 95% of the people on the planet. And he's been doing it for how many years now?
Enough.
20. Well, let's see. When was the Olympics? 88, right? So there's 25 years, and he had in his amateur career had to be at least 4 or 5 years before that, probably even longer. So we may be looking 35 years.
I remember learning the boy. I think his father even started training him when he was not even 10 years old. So you got a man that's. He's 44 years old now, or something like that. And his father was training him, say, at the age of 10. That's 34 years' experience right there.
Yeah.
How many years on a championship level? The guy has won his first world title in 1993. 20 years on a championship level right there.
And when we talked to him, he still remembered his very first fight, from what I remember. Even though he's tough to understand at times, he's got all his faculties. He's a very fast talker.
he's a fast talker, but he's still clear.
Right.
You know, and I was saying, like, when we talked to Riddick Bowe, Riddick was slurring all over the place, and when he would laugh, we would laugh because we didn't know what he was saying. But Roy was very clear, very concise, and excellent memory. It's like, hey, Roy, I remember like this one fight. He goes, oh, yeah, the score was like 97-93, 97-93, 98-92. Oh, shit, really? Why, you knew that?
But Jackson also commented here on Bjorn Rebney and the differences between him and Dana White. Apparently, he feels like Rebney is more like him. He says, like Jackson, I mean. He says, me and him, Rebney, are a lot alike. I feel like he keeps it real. What he just said about pay-per-views, I totally agree with that. He's not going to cram it down fans' throats every month and do a pay-per-view. I think that's what the UFC is doing, and I think the UFC now is messing up the sport. They're just doing a lot of bad things, and I just feel like Bellator, the way they're doing things, is kind of the future of the sport. So, like I said, Ortiz and Rampage are both on a UFC hater spree here. I don't think it's very healthy for them, especially before they have their first fight in Bellator. I mean, it'd be one thing if they had their first fight and, you know, made the pay-per-view a huge success, and they can talk all they want, but I just had a big problem.
Exactly. It's almost like you're not my opponent, Tito. You're not my opponent, Rampage. Dana is our opponent. Yeah.
Right. and... You know, I just hope that I really do hope that they do prove the UFC wrong for not signing them both. I think the UFC really dropped the ball, and you know, if they really wanted to crush their opponents, they could have just, you know, signed both of those guys and let them finish their careers in the UFC. I mean, after all, the UFC put Ortiz in the Hall of Fame before they let him go, so kind of didn't make sense to me, at least on that front. I know Rampage was speaking out against the UFC before he even left. But in Tito Ortiz's case, I think Dana picked a fight with him before he even decided to come back. So I don't understand where he's coming from there. But there's our 60-second warning, so we'll call it a night. I definitely. I know there's a big Friday night fight set coming up this weekend. This tomorrow night.
Before we get off the air, I wanted to tell you after last week's show. Rich, I went to that email between you and Kathy Guva, and I emailed her that Gotti tribute article I wrote a few years ago, and she was nice enough to respond and tell me how much she really loved it. And I was so grateful and so thankful when I got that email from her,
and knowing that someone that knew Arturo personally loved the article that much. And she said she also wishes he would have had a chance to read it.
And we'll have her on the show again, I'm sure. She did keep that open. So.
Okay, well, hey, if it's a little time, I'll still be the baby.
All right,
see
guys.
Next week.